Hello, I'm Stefan Bayer and welcome to another episode of School Must Go On. Today in English, because today we put Denmark in the spotlight. I'm talking to Jeppe Bundsgaard, who is a professor at the Danish School of Education and the Danish representative at the worldwide ICILS study, which compares computer and information literacy of students around the world. In the podcast, we get filled up about the important aspects of Danish education system and how it is different, especially when it comes to digital education. Jeppe puts decades of reforms and educational research in perspective. One story that struck me most is the rise of a small startup that became the largest provider of digital educational materials almost overnight. Have fun listening and learning. Hello, Dr. Professor Jeppe Bundsgaard. It's great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here.
You are a landmark. A lot of people around Europe know you because you are an educator, you are an IT specialist, and you are responsible for a lot of changes in the Danish education ecosystem over the past couple of years. And I'm really happy that we can talk today about Denmark and get inspired by Denmark and get your opinion on some pressing issues in the education system. And I would love to start out our talk with the question, what is Denmark doing differently? And I know it's not an easy question, and you can pick one or two things that you really like to emphasize.
I could start by saying that we have learned a lot from Germany. A lot of our thinking about good education is founded in German thinkers. So first of all, we have learned a lot from Germany, which I would suggest that others do as well, maybe even Germany. And second, I would say that we are. I think that it's not that our education system is without flaws. We have a lot of problems, but we have also done something right by developing a system where. We are thinking of students as whole human beings that are going to develop as humans while they go to primary, lower secondary school, even secondary school. We have a relationship between teachers and students that is very equal. So we are not. Students are talking to teachers as almost as if they were at the same level. We don't use C or the Herr Bundsgaard or anything like that. We just call people by their first name. I think it's an important basis, and it's also important that we, I think almost 40 years ago, we stopped having any kind of tracking. So we all students go to the same type of school. Until ninth or tenth grade. So I think that's a good basis. And then we have since back in the 60s, there's been or even back to the 20s when the reform movement started in Europe. And I think it came in many ways from the US, but it was also big in Denmark and in Germany. So we have this. We have tried to develop a school system that is more student-centered, more project-based, more geared toward, as I said, developing whole human beings, not just focusing strongly on drills and practice of simple, correct, non-correct answers. We haven't succeeded in any ways, but we are trying, and we have been trying, and I think many Danes think of the Danish system as if it was something like that, but when we look at it in empirically, it's not. There's way too much time spent on stupid drill and practice, on getting correct answers to really simple questions. But I think what you might want to hear is also that we, as a Danish, the Danish society, but especially the Danish school system, started getting digitized very early on. So we had actually back in the 60s, we had the first professor of computer science. He invented the word datology. So that he was actually a professor of datology, so the science of using data. And he, as one of the first things he did, was to work very seriously on getting computer science into basic education. Not in order for students to actually be able to program, but in order for them to be able to understand how computers work, what computers will do to our society. And he was mostly talking about how it would be in the future, but today we see that he was right, that computers have changed everything. Unfortunately, he didn't succeed in actually creating a subject that students were taught, but we had some elective studies subjects through the 70s and 80s, but that like laid the groundwork for computers being a core part of how we've been thinking about education since then. And then in the 80s and the 90s, there were a lot of small projects trying to integrate ICT into all subjects actually. And in the 20th century or in the 2000s, we started to have really large scale projects and initiatives that introduced ICT into all schools. So already around the year 2000, almost all schools in Denmark were connected to the internet, and computers were part of it. It wasn't part of everyday life at that time, but in around 2015, you wouldn't come to a school without ICT being completely integrated into teaching and learning. So that was a very quick overview of the Danish context.
When we look at international data, we see that Denmark is leading in terms of digital schools, but also in terms of integrating 21st century skills. You also told us about a reform that now makes all students go to the same school until 9th or 10th grade. These gigantic changes, would you say that it's in the DNA of the Danish education system to change, to be able to change, to love and embrace change?
When you say it like that, I would love if that was the case, but I think we also need to remember that Denmark is a small country. We are like 6 million people, so it's like one of your states. So in Denmark we have this. We understand that we do not have big industries, or we do, but we do not have resources, natural resources. We do not have motor companies or so on. So our biggest companies are companies that produce high-end medicine, like Novo Nordisk. It's the playing company Lego. So innovation is that's we are talking about what we need to make a living from is our brains, and I think that makes us aware that we cannot stay with old times the way we did it in the old times, and I think that's an understanding that we share as a people, and therefore we understand that we need to change schools. We need to make students prepared for the community that they are part of now and will be part of in the future. So therefore, for example, project-based learning has been part of what students should go through during their school time, years in school, and the Ministry of Education has been pushing for integration or development of 21st century skills. There's even in our curriculum, there's like three cross-cutting areas. One of them is entrepreneurship and innovation, which should be part of all subjects. ICT should be part of all subjects, and language awareness should be part of all subjects. So in that sense, that yes, we have we had this very innovative curriculum made in 1964, which has like paved the way for always trying to rethink how to get up to date with our curriculum in schools. So in that sense, I would say yes. But it's not that everything is then innovative and modern, and we do a lot of things that aren't very clever or sensitive or wise. Schools, if you go into a Danish school, a lot of things would look exactly how you would expect it to look if you went into schools in other countries.
And
students
the
sitting in rows and so on.
And the stakeholders who are responsible, there's the ministry you mentioned, you are from the scientific body, there is the union, there is the administration, there is the students, there's the parents, the public, the civic sector. Do you have a feeling of them working well together, like a well-oiled machine to get change done?
We had this reform in 2014, which was also combined with a reform of the working conditions for teachers. So they were asked to, or not asked, they were forced to work more and stay at school for longer hours and so on. And at that point, everything was ruined. So if you had asked me before that, I would say that yes, of course, they are opponents, the teachers and the municipalities, which are the ones who hire them. Mm. But they have the same, they understand school should be this place for development of people. But something happened in 2014, and I think that we are repairing it now, that it's being better. And I think if we look aside from these 6 years, I would say that yes, teachers and municipalities, the Ministry of Education, they have the same vision. They have the same ideology or understanding of what schools should be and how to get there. But of course, they are also fighting over how much they should be paid and how many teachers there should be and so on. But yes, in like in the grand picture, yes, we've been we have this you would say ideology of collaboration between both the ones who what do we call them, the employers and the employees, and that's a part of the Danish labor market that employers and employees are figuring out in collaboration how to organize and what wages should be and so on. So we try to keep the state out of that relationship. We don't have minimum wage, for example, in Denmark, but we have very high wages compared to many other countries. So we have this collaboration as a basis for deciding things.
Can you walk me through a day in the life of a student, very average student, and the things I would experience? Let's say I'm a middle school student in Denmark on a normal weekday, non-pandemic times, maybe.
It is very different. It depends on. So if you were in one of the really innovative schools, you would come to school, you would maybe even make your own schedule, you would go on with the project you started yesterday, you would you would collaborate with fellow students, but this happens at maybe 10% of the Danish schools, if I'm that's even maybe too positive. What would be the general average student would come to school. He would know that the first lesson was Danish, so he should maybe read a short novel or do some grammar or spelling exercises. But he would do it on computer in Denmark. Mm-hmm. It would, for most students, it would be computer based, and it would be using one of the platforms developed by our, we have like three or four large publishing companies that have really invested a lot in developing these platforms. So he or she would sit at her table doing this work. Maybe they would, there would be some group work during this lesson. The teacher would give some instructions and walk in the class and talk to students. Students would be mostly be happy. They would make some fun, have some, say some jokes, and the teacher would laugh with the students. And then in the end, they would talk about the work they'd been doing. And then next lesson starts, it would be math and so on, as you would recognize it from other countries. But I think what would be different from other contexts would be this relationship between students and teachers, and maybe also so Danish teachers would encourage some amount of opposition, even or creativity, or students who are making a little extra, getting the other students amused and so on, would be appreciated and encouraged.
And the grading aspect? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. The grading wouldn't happen before earliest at eighth grade in most schools. So that's, of course, very important and different from many other countries that we are not. So until a few years ago, actually, we didn't have exams in Danish lower secondary schools. We only had what we called, we didn't call it exam. It was a test that you could take when you left school, and you could get grades at that point, but you weren't forced to have it. You could do without going to that exam. But today it's mandatory to take the exam, and you are going to have grades in eighth and ninth grade, and sometimes you would get it before in order to practice and so on. So we have gone towards more focus on grades and exams, but to me, in my opinion, way too much, because it has a backlash on how things are done. Teachers are too worried about the exams. They are too focused on preparing students for exams instead of focusing on preparing them for the life they are living, the students. But that's a discussion we have. But compared to other countries, it's way less.
And I got one thing in my mind. I just have to say it. Yeah, I'm thinking the traditionalist, conservative, middle class is forcing schools to grade and to push kids in different schools. Yeah, so traditionalists can conserve their social status. Yeah, and I just needed to say that that's I think one of the reasons why in Germany it would be so hard to push for such a reform. And I wonder if that also pushed for more grading in Denmark, or if that came from a more scientific point of view, saying, hey, let's try this out. Let's give a bit more grades, force teachers a bit more to be measured and see where it leads us. What was the driving force behind it?
I would say exactly what you said. So it's not, researchers would not suggest having more grading, more focus on testing, because what we know is that so you could differentiate between mastery and what do you call it, prestationen, I don't know what the English word is, but you if you are focused on actually understanding and being good at something, or if you are focused on getting high grades. And the problem is that when you introduce grades and tracking and so on, then you focus on getting high grades, not on mastering things. And yes, you're correct. This is a push that's coming from the outside. It's not that I'm saying that grading couldn't be good for some things or getting, but what's good is getting feedback that tells you what you do good and what you could be better at and how you could improve. This is what works. The problem is that numbers, the only thing you see is the number, not how can I improve. So yes, it's coming from the outside, and yes, it's coming from middle-class parents who expect schools to be exactly as it was when they went to school, or even when their parents went to school. And it's not doing much good. We have this national testing, which actually exists before eighth grade, and in a sense, it's resulting in grades for students. But we are fighting. Because what happens when you introduce these kinds of instruments, you get students to focus on getting high grades, not on doing good.
So yeah, seems like one of the global pain points for everyone working in academics and research in the field of education, that what society thinks is always, oh, I've been to school, I know what's good to do in school, or even worse, you argue that homework doesn't make sense, that grades don't make sense. And then people will say, I had homework, I was graded, it didn't hurt me. Do you also see that sort of force sometimes driving the public discussion?
Yes, definitely I do. And it's not, I wouldn't say that homework is always bad, because if homework is some kind of a preparation, for example, if you are asked to go back and make an interview with your parents, or investigate how much water you use, or maybe even write a short story, then it can make sense to do homework. But the problem is that homework typically is something where you need help from your teachers and you don't get it. So the students with the parents that are academics will do good, and students without will do bad. But yes, I see it as a mostly as a pressure from the outside, from people thinking that, and that's, I think, both. So we are in an area where everybody thinks, that everybody is interested, everybody has opinions, and everybody thinks that their experiences, like, can count for, like, good arguments in this discussion. And sometimes it does. Of course, we can use our experiences, but we also, of course, people need to understand that there is actually someone who actually looked a little further into it. This is us who actually try to understand how things works. And when we say something, it's not just something we think. We actually, we try to have, like, reasons behind what we think. But also, I think we should acknowledge and be happy that so many people think this is interesting and want to participate in the discussion.
Yeah. Earlier you said, if you would walk me through a normal day of a student's life in Denmark, there's two kinds of schools you could portray. There's the more average, and then there's the really, really innovative school, which you said maybe 10%, a little less. Is this a spearhead of the new wave, the new generation of schools? And can you tell me a little bit about how you drive progress with these schools? What's your vision for these schools? And yeah, what you do with them, because they're state schools, I guess, they're not private schools, so it must be part of a government program.
So in Denmark we have this tradition, I think, as in Germany, for trying out things in real contexts. So innovative principals of schools or teachers, or they say, okay, let's try this, try to change this fundamentally. Sometimes it goes completely off track and it turns out not to be a good idea. But I think one of the things that we have seen through all years, for the last 40 years, is that sometimes schools have decided, okay, now we actually want to be more student-centered, more inquiry-based, project-based. And sometimes they succeed. But it's an extremely difficult change, because it's a lot more difficult to be teacher in this context. It's also more difficult to be student if you don't do not take it very seriously, that it's not easy to make projects or work independently on your own or in group work and so on. So, but what we have seen, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years in Denmark is that still more schools try to say, okay, let's try to really go the project-based direction. We have these LEAP schools. It's a project, I think, originated in the US, where schools try to really do it more project-based, especially with a focus on science education, but also in the other subjects. And we have schools that we have also have schools that say, let's try to use more drama, more role-based education. Or so we have schools that try different things out. And I think in recent years we have still more of that kind of schools. And they are it's correct, they are part of government or they are public funded schools often. Some of them are private, but most private schools are but many private schools are exactly as conservative as you would expect from schools to be. The schools are, it's something that they decide for themselves, or the municipality says, let's try to change all our schools in this direction. So it's possible under the circumstances that we have, even though many teachers say that this reform that we got in 2014 makes it impossible for us to do something innovative, but some schools show that it's actually possible.
And if a school says, I'm gonna venture out, I'm gonna try something new, is there a lot of autonomy for schools to decide this on their own? Budgets, decisions within the teacher staff to just say, we're gonna do something different? Or is there a lot of centralized decision making within a municipality or a state?
Yeah, so we have this situation where the state, so the municipalities own the schools, but the state puts up a lot of rules, of course. But we have had this centralization tendency for quite a long time. But in recent years, there's been an understanding that it has gone way too far. So there's this understanding that we need to give the power back to municipalities and to schools. So it's both that the laws are being slowly changed, but it's also the understanding at the Ministry of Education and in the municipalities that we need to delegate power to the schools. So I think we have a tradition of decentralized decision making in Denmark, but this tradition was for a time rolled back. I think it's rolled out again now. So yes, schools do have their own budgets, but they are highly restricted, of course, by teachers' wages and so on, and the rules for how many hours students should have at least, and all kinds of things. But I think it's areas where the municipalities can give power back to schools. Anyway, it's possible for schools to be completely different than other schools. So we have schools without, a schedule for the day. So it's possible to completely make things different under the law that we have now.
And when you drive change from school to school, is there somewhere the element of competition between school and school, competition for maybe budgets or competition for just the students? Will you have more or less students this year because the school next door might win some students from yours? Do you somehow play with the element of competition to drive change and excellence, or is that practically non-existent?
It was an explicit wish of a previous government, right-wing government, that they wanted more competition between schools, and they got it to some extent. But the problem is that most of the information that parents can use for selecting schools are hearsay and maybe it's not that they are in, they do not have the information that makes them actually prepared for taking these kind of decisions. So, but of course, so this competition between schools and it's very much connected to having the right narrative in the community about this school. So I think, but it's not. So some schools could use, of course, some of the more innovative schools. Of course, they use their innovativeness to try to get good students to their schools or many students to their schools. But it's also, we also have these. You belong to a school, so you need to, if you want to put your student to another school or your kid to another school, then this school is able to say no, you cannot come here because we already filled up or. So, but schools are competing, but not in a destructive way yet, I would say.
And how about the teacher training, the professional development of teachers? How do you organize that in Denmark?
So we have teacher colleges, and you sign up for teacher college. You go to this teacher college for 4 years. And during these 4 years, you have, I think, around half a year of practicum where you go to a school and try out teaching. These are not at university level. So teachers can actually, after they have finished their 4 years, they can take 2 more years of a master's degree, actually at my university, to get a master's degree. And then they can teach actually at the teacher colleges. But there has been this for the last 20 years almost, I think, there's been this tendency towards having more academic teacher education, more focus on academic competences. Mm. And there's this discussion, should we go for a 5-year teacher education and should it be university-based or how shall we? Because that's what our neighboring countries in the to the north, Norway, and I think Sweden as well. But anyway, Norway has decided to have these 5 years teacher education at university level. And I think we are going in that direction as well.
And once teachers are done on the college or on the university level, and they are in the middle of their career years, and they want to learn something new, is that something that's organized by the school, by the municipality, or is it state organized, the workshops or seminars that you probably offer for teachers to stay up to date?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all three of them. I think it's mostly it's decided at school level mostly, but municipalities can decide that all teachers in this municipality are going to have this ICT course or whatever. It's mostly. So our teacher colleges are also providing further education or professional development courses for teachers.
Cool.
So, yeah.
And that happens online, offline, or is it happening in the school or in seminar houses or auditoriums?
Yeah, all of it. But I think one of the things that many of our research projects has shown in recent years is that we need to go as close to schools as possible. We need to have more teachers at the same school taking part of the same professional development.
Yeah.
So I think this is the direction that it's going, that we are having consultants coming to school or schools participating in the project with collaboration internally in the teacher college at the school.
And is it all run by the state, or earlier you mentioned textbook companies or media companies who are providing the software to learn and the content to learn for the students? Is teacher training something that is privatized, or is it completely owned by the state?
It's actually right now the politicians are discussing to introduce competition also in teacher education, creating a new teacher education. But it is, we have a teacher education that is for, they are not actually accepted in public schools, but they are accepted in private schools. We have a lot of different kinds of private schools, the Freine Waldorf or Rudolf Steiner schools. We have so all kinds of private schools, and they the teachers from are typically from the teacher college that's not allowed to teach in public schools. So the professional development courses are typically provided by these public teacher colleges, but we also have privatized people or companies that on, and the publishing houses are giving some professional development courses, but it's mostly connected to their specific materials that they are selling. So, yeah.
Maybe let's talk about the content and the that technology that students use a little bit more practically around the world on conferences that I've been. There is people talking about Denmark, and there is this saga about the old textbook companies who didn't manage to go digital, and then overnight there was a law change making that made everything digital, and then a small startup rose to the top and became the new large content and curriculum provider. That's what I've heard many times, but I've never heard the details or the names around this. Maybe it's just a saga, maybe it's just gossip, but you probably know everything, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a saga. It's so we have this one publishing company called Clio Online, which is, as its name says, an online publishing company. They started out developing material for history, so it was actually two history teachers or university-educated history teachers who started this company, and they made this platform for history education. And then they slowly developed also into the Danish subject and other subjects. So they existed, and then in 2012, after having tried out many different ways of trying to have more ICT use in schools, so we had several projects before that. But in 2012, the government decided to fund if schools wanted to buy digital teaching material, they would fund 50%. And that was this overnight decision that really made, in my opinion, a very positive change. Because up until then, we had this Clio Online. The publishing houses were developing all kinds of digital material. It's not that they didn't. They tried all kinds of things, but they couldn't make it into a business model. So in 2012, we decided to fund with 50% all acquisition of digital teaching material, and that made Clio Online huge, and it also made Gyldendal, which was the old publishing house. It's like a huge company in Denmark, not in comparison with you in Germany, but another publishing house called Alinea also, after some time, managed to actually get on board. So we have these three big players on the market, and then we have some other companies that make specific learning management systems or combined administrative and learning management systems that have also managed to actually survive and develop things that are usable. So what I think that what made the difference was that from 2012 and forward, actually, use of ICT became an everyday experience for students all over Denmark at all grade levels, especially in the upper grades, but also even in first and second grade. So what I think you've heard about Clio Online, and it is a very big Danish company now, but it's not the only one.
And so what the government anticipated was that, because you had laptops and computers before and learning management systems, the government anticipated if we now fund the content, if we now fund the teaching material, the actual teaching material, this will drive ICT adoption.
Yes, that exactly, because we had spent billions of Danish kroner on hardware in many different projects, and municipalities had like put so many money down to that hole without really seeing a change. And the decision to actually, so what we were saying from the researchers community was that it you cannot as a teacher come up with teaching material yourself. You have to have support. And when the government decided to actually give that support, to actually provide teaching material for all students, all teachers, all subjects, that was the thing that made the huge difference. But of course, we needed to have a well-functioning infrastructure. We needed to have high-quality Wi-Fi. We needed to have power supplies in classrooms. We needed to have computers in classrooms. We needed, so there were many things, and teachers needed to be comfortable using these technologies. Many things had to be available at the same time. But what we were lacking at that time was actually teaching material. And I think that's the challenge for most countries, that you need to develop a lot of teaching material in order to actually have a day-to-day use of ICT in education.
And the government's idea to give some extra money to subsidize by 50%. Now, with the sort of teaching material we're talking about, it's usually an annual license fee. You pay it year after year, or maybe you pay a 3-year contract. So the government just said, from now on until forever, we're going to chip in 50%. We're going to pay half the bill. Or was it a time-limited offer, and then the municipalities had to somehow organize the money on their own at some point, because they're not buying software once. I'm paying my Microsoft Word license practically every year. And so, how did that work out in the long term? Who's paying the bills for digital teaching material today?
Yeah, it was a limited time offer. It was, I think it was until 2017. It was expanded a few years, and I think it ended in 2017. But at that point, first of all, schools were used to using this material, and it was developed, or the companies had found out how to have a business plan. So it has, it was, but it did kick off the development, and it made the companies sure that they would have funding for some years. So, but it was exactly as you said. And now we have the problem that, of course, we have, the schools have lost 50% of their budget for teaching material, and it's maybe it's not so hard on the digital teaching material, but it might be hard on other important parts of their budget. So, but I guess that was the price that was paid. And I think it's important to say that what has happened is exactly as you say. They have changed from, so in early on, teachers would sit in small groups. So Danish subject teachers, math teachers, and so on would sit and say, okay, we have this amount of money. Should we buy these books or those books, or what should we save up for next year? And now, mostly it's going on that way, that the municipalities are getting good contracts with the companies. So all teachers in the same municipality have to use the same learning platform, which is not necessarily such a good idea. So we are discussing different solutions. For example, the government is trying, or the Ministry of Education is pushing for some kind of micro payment, so teachers can get their decision power back and say, I want to use this particular part of your system, but not that the whole package.
Wow, sorry.
You can. It sounds like, for example, like Spotify or whatever. It's like pay per use. But the problem is that the publishing houses say that the expensive part is not this particular small bit. It's the whole system. It's the infrastructure in the system that really costs money to develop. So they have a problem with these micro payments solutions. But I think we need to find a way to avoid centralizing further.
Yeah, I guess the companies say, I have no forecast possibility for my revenue anymore if I'm not signing up for the big licenses. And so I don't know how many people can I employ, how many can I invest, how much money should I keep in the bank, because I don't know what kind of times I'm heading into. But or this whole decision sounds like next level stuff for Germany, where we don't even have state licenses. It's quite an amazing view into a future here. Yeah. During those times and also now, is it ever a big part of public discussion or within the administration, a big part of decision making that these companies are coming from Denmark? Because we have this in Germany at the moment that some people, they're like, nah, I don't care where teaching materials and teaching tools come from. And other people are like, no, we need to really fund German companies who are doing this. How did Denmark handle the situation?
Yes. Definitely, we have had, it's not that it has been a public discussion, but we are discussing the challenges of American companies or even Chinese companies taking over Danish education. And I think that is one point of view. The other is that we are in the forefront, so our companies might take over the world. Yeah. But definitely, right now we are discussing Google Education, of course, because they are sucking up our students' data, and a lot of municipalities have actually been using it to provide data for Google from their students unlawfully. But so we have these discussions, and definitely. But you could say that in a sense we have this advantage that Denmark is such a small market that it's not that important for global companies to come to Denmark. But of course, Pearson, for example, would be a huge challenge for the German market, because they could see a way of really earning money on that market. And I wouldn't like if one of these global players would come and decide, because what they do is not only decide, they end up having a clear say on what should actually be taught. Yeah. And that is,
What I always observe is that these companies, especially the Chinese and American companies, they only go deep to a certain point into the education system. Like, they will provide the learning management system, the messaging, the file sharing, the calendar, and maybe the questionnaire tool. But they will not go into content themselves. Yeah. So they will provide this beautiful Google Classroom, which some find hard to say no to because it's for free. And they might also supply Google Meet, which is a really well-functioning video conferencing tool, especially during the pandemic, and you don't even have to pay for it. But they won't go into the content part where they teach Danish or German history. That's what I feel. And still people, they've got a reason, and they're arguing for that reason that even this shouldn't happen because there's data at stake.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I agree with those people who say that there's data at stake. Of course, if something is free, you are the product. I think that's it's such a wise sentence that we need to understand. And I think it's not up to us to give our students data to American companies. I think we are not allowed to do that, not morally and not lawfully, legally. So, but I think it would. I would be afraid actually also of because. So in Denmark we have these companies that in many ways they decide curriculum because they develop the content. We have these curriculum descriptions of what should be taught and so on. But there's a huge area for actually filling this out. And I think the quality of the material that these companies produce is, in my opinion, not at all high enough. It's not good enough. And I think that's a problem of because they are producing, but they are selling not necessarily what is good for students. So I think that's a discussion that we need to have. And I think when we are centralizing things, it's an even more important discussion to have. Is this content good enough? And what would happen if Pearson went into the German market, I think what you would see would be a content provider as well. And they would try to translate the American content into a German context. And that wouldn't necessarily be good for the German educational system, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it depends on how user-centric this will be done in the future. Mm-hmm. And we can see it all over software development that everyone became very user-centric over the past 10 years, and education is kind of like lagging behind a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it's also starting to happen there, that there's a first, a second, and a third generation of online education providers, who the first ones were just the ones winning practically the brains of the politicians, who were like, wow, this is cool. Yeah, not a lot of scientific research done to make a public tender. And now more and more efficacy comes into play, and people really want to see results, and they want to see user studies, and they want to see testimonials of students and so on. I guess that's where education and content creation will lead as well, that you can't develop something and just push it into the market. You really need to test it all the time and reiterate as many times as you can. One last question around the offerings from international players. One thing that I see around Europe happening is actually that within the EU, people are quite cool with offerings. Like half of Germany seems like is using the Norwegian learning management system, It's Learning, and is very much opposed to use any sort of Microsoft, Google, and so on software. So there's this three-step ladder practically of you have something from your own country, have something from the EU, or is it America or China? Is it the same in Denmark as well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we are finally, I think people are waking up and understanding that China and the US aren't necessarily our friends, and they might have interests that are not aligned with ours. So yes, I think it's the same, but we have been so the back of the coin of being an early mover in ICT is that we have been extremely blue-eyed, or we have just if it's ICT, it's good. More of that, but I think now people are beginning to understand that it's not always good to have more ICT in education, and it's not necessarily good to get things for free unless it's open source and really free. It's the same discussions that we have.
But would you say that now during the pandemic, everyone's really happy that Denmark took the road into a very ICT-heavy education system? Because in my imagination, not having been in Denmark for the past month, it must be much, much different than Germany, where teachers don't have email addresses of their own school. They use their own private email addresses. At least the majority, more than 60% right now, of the teachers' learning management systems. Half the students might have one. The ones that the state built have been crashing all the time during the beginning of 2021. We don't have to worry about Wi-Fi and devices within the schools right now, because there's no school opened at the moment, but that's the next big shock, that there's no fiberglass cables bringing fast internet to the schools, and this will all take until 2026 to be done. But I think a lot of people should be clapping being very happy in Denmark right now, giving a lot of applause to the people who made these decisions.
Yeah, I don't think people are aware that it's a special situation in Denmark. I think, but if they were, I think they would be clapping. It is true that Danish children could start the corona crisis running almost. They were. It wouldn't take long for them to. They would already have all Danish students have this. It's called Uni Login, so they have this login that works for everything, and they were used to using it. That we had well functioning learning management system. We had a communication system that was just rolled out to replace an old one that we also had for many years. So Danish students, Danish parents, Danish teachers were all used to using ICT at an almost daily basis. And what was new, of course, was that they now had to use video conferencing and communicate synchronously or online with their teachers. It's not that it has been like without problems, but when I compare to Germany, for example, and other countries that I've heard about or know about, then I do agree. Yes, it was extremely lucky that we had these 30 years of wasting a lot of money on hardware and bad software solutions.
What's the best way to do hybrid or complete online remote learning for Danish students today? Is it rebuilding the daily life schedule and going from one video conference to another, or is there an element of asynchronous learning as well? What has the Danish education system come up with as the best practice after almost 12 months in the pandemic?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that anybody could answer it, but I would say that the discussions that we have is that it doesn't work out well if you're sitting by the computer all day long, but it doesn't work out well if you are just asked to fill out the blanks on digitized paper sheets on the computer. So I think there's a lot of discussions or a lot of communication among teachers at the websites for teachers and so on about how to do things good. And I think a lot of teachers are trying to integrate asynchronous off-screen work, like asking students to listen to see a video or walk and listen to some sound. Or a talk by someone, or to collaborate by talking in small groups. Or I think they're trying out all kinds of things. But you would see a huge variety of different ways of doing it. But I think they were better prepared for this second lockdown than they were for the first. But they have been sharing a lot of experiences also in the time when they weren't locked down. Danish students got back to school in June and stayed until November. So there was a time when teachers could talk about the experiences they had during the lockdown. And I think that it's useful for them now.
Very cool. Very cool. From my personal experience, a lot of my friends, they're sharing anecdotes, and they're saying in Germany, it very much depends on the teacher you have. You can have a teacher who's completely ICT illiterate, and then all you get is a package of printed out worksheets once a week. Mm-hmm. Or you can have someone who's really pulling it off and who's really doing a great job and practically doing something cool every day. There's like this gigantic variety that I probably don't expect happening in Denmark right now to such an extreme from zero to 100.
No, I think we would be from 50 to 100 on that, I think, because almost all teachers are ICT literate, and I think all of them are communicating with their students to some extent online, and they're not sending out paper sheets to work with. That's for sure.
Sorry. I got one question about the future and how this might shape teacher habits. Do you see that the pandemic is changing Danish teachers in a long-term way? So teaching will look different once the pandemic is over, because they've gotten used to certain things that they've like really done heavily during the pandemic, like, I don't know, using video or something else. Is there a longer lasting effect in the didactical work of a teacher?
Yes, I think so. I think so, but I think it's also connected actually to really appreciating how much it actually means to have a social life and to be together with your body. So I think that it might even mean that they would try to integrate more movement into teaching and learning, more collaboration, more talk, and so on. But it would also mean that they know a lot more about how to integrate small videos or all kinds of digital tools. And I'm sure that the teachers who weren't on at their best or very affluent in using ICT, they are much more used to it today, and they would be much better at integrating it. But I think it's important to say that they have also understood what they lost in the time when everything had to go on online.
Hmm. So you living in Denmark, the education system that's at the very front line of what's new in digitization, and you also being part of the drivers of digitization in schools in Denmark, where do you get your inspiration from? What's something that gets you excited when you look around the world and you see how the educational system can evolve even more?
That's a good question. I think my inspiration comes from John Dewey or Wagenschein or Klafke. I'm trying to realize the ideas that came up in the reform movement in the 20s, that we need to have teaching and learning that is much more student centered and much more actively engaging and authentic. So I see colleagues all over the world trying to realize these kind of things, and that's what together with teachers, and that is what is inspiring me. When I started, I expected project-based learning, for example, to be much more prevalent in Danish schools, but it wasn't. Yeah. And so I've been interested in understanding why isn't it, because everybody knows it's a better way of teaching. Yeah. or a better way of learning anyway. So much of my work has been centered on understanding all the challenges that you meet and finding out how to use ICT to support teachers and students in making it more realizable, or I don't know what to say, but make it more possible for them to actually do more meaningful teaching and learning.
Fantastic. Jeppe Bunskart, thank you so much. That was an amazing hour. So much density, so much interesting talk, and so much very clear thinking. I'm very grateful to have had you in the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for talking to me. It was great.